I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Michael Isgoff.
And this is Spy Talk, and there's only one story this week, right, Mike? It is Israel and intelligence on Israel. We have a big split, let's call it that, between the national intelligence agencies and Donald Trump on what Iran has. And Donald Trump, the president of the United States, said yesterday of his chief intelligence advisor, I don't care what she says.
Well, I mean, well, first of all, given Tulsi Gabbard's track record, I'm not sure I would disagree with the president's assessment on that one. But look, I'm of two minds on this because it strikes me as a pretty close call on what the U.S. Should do here, or at least on what the intelligence is. Yes, it's true that U.S. intelligence agencies have said for some time since the National Intelligence Estimate in 2007 that Iran had suspended its efforts to develop a nuclear bomb.
Turned out to be baloney.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly there was a lot. First of all, like the very next part of that NIE, in fact, in the same sentence was an affirmation that this does not mean that Iran is not seeking to develop a nuclear bomb. They assessed that there were enrichment activities going on, but you know what? They didn't even know about the Fordo facility when they wrote that NIE in 2007. So we should not purport to pretend that this was a gold-plated NIE. You know, many intelligence estimates, it had gaps, it had failings.
Okay. Well, let's go up to the present time. And so in March, Tulsi Gabbard getting feed-in from all the intelligence agencies. She's the titular head of all intelligence. So she's getting input from the NSA, from CIA. And we talked to a very former senior CIA official for a piece we wrote last week saying they are a couple of years away. Now, what seems to be confused here or combined is what we know Iran, what do we think we Iran wants to do, and what's the actual state of their ability to make a bomb? And that's where the big discrepancy is.
Right. And look, you have just like the week before the Israelis launched this attack on Iran, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, assessed that Iran was in violation of proliferation agreements, right? That it was continuing to develop and enrich uranium. It was not declaring its nuclear sites. It was not cooperating with investigators. And there was ample reason to believe that it was intent on developing a nuclear weapon. The only question is, how close are they? And
absolutely,
you have reports that, 60% to as high as 80% enrichment. That's not too far from the 90% that could do it. Yeah.
It's another area of confusion, because enrichment, you can enrich the hell out of it without having a bomb. And that's where the debate sits, where, I mean, it's not so easy to take enriched uranium, actually make a workable bomb. Remember the size of the one at Los Alamogordo? You know, I mean, Fat Boy was fat. It was 6 feet wide. Yeah. So to actually take enriched uranium and make a bomb that can screw on the tip of a missile is mm-hmm. another thing, or even make something you can put in the back of a pickup truck. It's another question altogether. But we are lucky enough to have somebody who's been in the mosh pit of decision making on Iran years ago. Ned Price, tell us about Ned.
Ned Price is the perfect person to speak to this. He was a CIA analyst for years on counterterrorism programs, and then he became a spokesman for the National Security Council under President Barack Obama. And we'll talk about Obama and Iran nuclear programs. It was Obama who unleashed a cyber offensive, the first offensive cyber act of war to dismantle Iran's nuclear program. So he was not satisfied that Iran had ended or was not intent on developing a nuclear bomb. And then Ned Price served. He quits the CIA when Trump gets elected in protest, and then later became a deputy UN ambassador under President Biden. But he's been outspoken.
He knows what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's an advocate of diplomacy. And by the way, look, I am keenly aware of what a debacle the Iraq war was for the United States.
Wars are easy to start.
Wars are easy to start. Nasty dictators are sometimes easy to topple. The question is what comes after? What comes after that? And that's the dilemma that our Hamlet in the White House is facing right now, going back and forth.
That's putting fine gloss on him.
Well, he doesn't Hamlet. Know what to do.
He doesn't know his own mind.
He doesn't know his own mind.
Or we don't know what the mind is, what level of mind is. But anyway, without further ado, let's bring in Ned. Hi there, Ned Price. You are just a perfect person to have aboard. You've been involved in Iran talks for decades. So we want to talk to you about the biggest story of the week in our part of the world, which is the intelligence division at the top of the administration, where Tulsi Gabbard issued a threat assessment in March saying Iran was not close to building a nuclear weapon. Acquiring a nuclear weapon, and the president saying, I guess it was yesterday, time flies these days, president uttering to reporters, I don't care what she has to say. So what do you make of all this?
Look, first of all, Jeff, Michael, it's great to see you. Thank you for having me on. In some ways, this division is very new, and in some ways, it's very old, dating back about 20 years. Obviously, it's new in the sense that it is really pivotal to the decision the president is going to make, how far Iran actually is from obtaining an actual nuclear weapon. And the division that we saw in sharp relief between President Trump and his director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, obviously that's all unfolded over the past several days, especially with new purported Israeli intelligence, what they call their golden information, that at least alludes to weaponization efforts that the United States government hasn't been able to corroborate previously. But in some ways, this division is very old, and it actually dates back about 20 years. And just for a bit of context, the United States intelligence community in 2007 produced an assessment that in the year 2003, 4 years prior, Iran had halted its efforts to weaponize, that is to say, to actually build a device, a nuclear bomb, in which the enriched uranium could go and actually be deployed. This was based on, we would later learn, new and authoritative information that the intelligence community developed around that time. And it was actually President George W. Bush, who, of course, is no Iran dove himself and was no Iran dove, who made the decision to declassify what was then this national intelligence estimate that had, you know, what was a pretty startling judgment to many people. And I think it was so startling to so many, and it was so controversial at the moment, because it really gets at what is a very complex issue, the difference between enrichment and weaponization. And of course, your listeners are familiar with it, both of you are familiar with it, but it's the process of enriching uranium versus, again, putting that enriched uranium in a bomb or a device that can be delivered on a battlefield or in the course of war. And so even in 2007, almost 20 years ago now, when this assessment was first declassified, it was met with strong criticism and condemnation from Congress, from other stakeholders who did not find the assessment to be credible. In some cases, it was because they failed to appreciate the distinction between enrichment and weaponization. In some cases, they failed to believe this new intelligence that Iran had actually halted this program. But actually, Jeff, this has been the United States government's consistent assessment since 2007. Again, nearly 20 years.
Let me break in here on a couple of points you raised.
Yep.
You cite the 2007 intelligence assessment saying it was based on authoritative information. But the U.S. intelligence community at that point was completely unaware of the Fordo enrichment facility built under 250 feet deep in a mountain, clearly a massive project that one would not associate with a civilian nuclear program, right? And, you know, I would point out that the president you work for, Barack Obama, unleashed the Stuxnet computer worm to dismantle the Iranian nuclear program. You know, several years after that assessment, clearly he
was concerned.
I'm
watching myself very closely so that I don't nod or you know, shake my head anyway. I don't want to comment on that.
Clearly, the president that you worked for was deeply concerned. And by the way, did that with the Israelis. This was a joint U.S.-Israeli project. The CIA director, Michael Hayden, the former CIA director, said the president had crossed a Rubicon in unleashing for the first time in world history, an offensive cyber attack on another country, all for the purpose of dismantling a nuclear program. If that assessment was so solid as you are suggesting, why would Barack Obama have gone to such lengths to attack the Iranian nuclear program many years ago?
Yeah. So a couple things, Michael, you're absolutely right that Fordo was not discovered prior to this 2007 assessment. But it is also notable that once it was discovered, once it was corroborated and confirmed, you know how it got out into the wild, into the public? It was Barack Obama, together with his French and British counterparts in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, of all places, in September of 2009, I recall, who went out and sort of did this dramatic presentation with this dramatic flourish to make clear that Iran had this secret covert enrichment facility. But again, this was an enrichment facility. I have not heard anyone credibly claim that Fordo was about anything other than enrichment, namely weaponization.
Do you really believe that? Do you really believe they would have built this giant project hundreds of feet under a mountain, obviously would have cost enormous amounts of money to keep it from being attacked because they simply wanted a civilian nuclear program?
By the way, the
U.S. intelligence community assessment is much more nuanced than that. I'm reading now from what Gabbard said in March of this year when she reaffirmed the previous decision. But then she went on to say, in the past year, we've seen an erosion of a decades-long taboo on Iran on discussing nuclear weapons in public, likely emboldening nuclear weapons advocates within Iran's decision-making. Iran's enriched uranium stockpile is at its highest levels and is unprecedented for a state without nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to give the impression, what would be a false impression, that Iran's enrichment program, Iran's nuclear program, wasn't of grave concern to every president I've worked for and every president since really, you know, Bill Clinton, certainly George W. Bush. It certainly was. That is why the Obama administration, in the first instance, starting with the secret diplomacy in the 2010s and the aughts, that involved Bill Burns, Jake Sullivan, their Iranian counterparts in Oman. That's why we set out, and the Obama administration set out, on a project to limit this and to put it in a tightly controlled box. You're absolutely right. It is almost certain that the Iranians were developing this secret enrichment program to maintain optionality. if they decided then or down the line that they wanted to pursue a nuclear weapons program, it would position them within a short distance of doing so, but there would still be a distance. But regardless, it was too close for comfort.
And not to take up Iran's cause in the slightest bit, but you can imagine they're facing a country with 90 nuclear weapons. You can see, and they look at what happened to Gaddafi in Libya, et cetera, you know, dictators overthrown and so on, Bashar al-Assad. They say, yeah, we better have a weapon of our own to defend ourselves. But I don't want to push that too far. I do want to get up to speed on what's going on. Who's driving the intelligence bus today? It seems like Israel is calling the shots and using all its public relations weapons to tilt the debate toward a U.S. involvement, direct involvement in the war with Iran. What do you say?
I think Israel obviously has a very strong point of view here. This point of view is not unique to this current moment. They have pushed every president in some ways since Bill Clinton to start a preemptive war against Iran, to end that optionality, to end that nuclear program, that enrichment program, whether civilian or otherwise. Of course, every president, at least up until now, has resisted that effort and has not allowed the United States to be drawn into it. Whether the United States is now drawn into it, I think, is a very open question. You know, I referred before to what Prime Minister Netanyahu has called his golden information. And the golden information, as best we can tell, I'm not aware that they've actually declassified or put out in public what they purport to have. But it does seem to contradict the longstanding finding of the U.S. intelligence community that Iran does not have an active weaponization program. So one of two things are possible here. Given the close relationship between Israel and the United States, the close intelligence relationship, to me, it is almost unfathomable that Israel would have consequential, credible information of this nature that they would not have shared with the U.S. intelligence community, with their counterparts. If they had
I want you to underscore that, that their relationship is so tight that it's unimaginable that the Israelis would keep critical intelligence on Iran nuclear progress from the Americans. So we know what they know.
There is very little we don't share with our Israeli partners, and we assume and we hope there is very little they don't share with us. But I think on this issue, something that would make the case that Iran is moving in the direction of weaponization, there is almost no question in my mind that the Israelis would share that with us because it fits their policy objectives. So if this information was shared with the United States, it seems to me that the U.S. intelligence community didn't find it credible because the assessment, as of March at least, has not changed. And if you listen to the statements the U.S. intelligence community has put out in recent days, that assessment remains valid. It remains the analytic line of the U.S. government. Now, perhaps it's possible that Israel has acquired this information in very recent days, recent hours, and didn't have time to share it with the United States, or chose not to for whatever reason. And that's why I find that very unlikely.
But look, let's go back to the IAEA, whose assessment only came out, what, a couple of weeks ago, declaring Iran was not in compliance with proliferation protocols and was keeping sites and keeping nuclear material secret from inspectors, refusing to divulge information. We've heard this before. I'm not arguing this makes the decision about whether the U.S. should bomb Fordo any easier. You know, I come back to Colin Powell's old, you know, pottery barn line. You know, if you break it, you own it. If we go into Iran with a full-scale attack, we will be responsible for what happens afterwards. And we have no idea what happens afterwards.
As we saw in Libya, if as some lines of thought say that Netanyahu's real objective is regime change,
yeah, Which, by the way, can I just say, you know, wouldn't be a bad thing. Whether we ought to be the orchestrators of it is a whole other question.
Well,
we've done that before and not done very well at it. But this is a very nasty regime in many ways, much nastier than Iraq was.
Like, you got to watch what you wish for. Iraq, Libya, etc. Yeah.
So I understand.
Those of you who want us to go riding in guns firing now, I think you ought to be a little bit more humble about a recent history.
I'm not advocating that.
So the question is, when is it the right time to strike Iran if we say nuclear weaponization is unacceptable? Should it be now, or should it be when they roll missiles out with nuclear warheads on them?
So a couple things. Number one, I think there are several points of commonality that we can all agree on. Number one, just as President Trump has said, President Biden said, President Obama said, President George W. Bush has said, Iran cannot, must not ever have a nuclear weapon. Where various people disagree, and I think reasonable people can disagree on this front, is how best to do that. And that's what we're talking about now, tactics rather than objectives. Number two, I would hope we would all agree that even though we all find this regime deeply unsavory, troubling, and we condemn its egregious excesses, including towards its own people in terms of their human rights and their freedoms, regime change imposed by the outside has never turned out well, certainly has never turned out well for us. If the Iranian people want to make a change, that is absolutely their right. And we would certainly understand their desire to do so. But regime change at the barrel of a gun is not something that I think the United States wants to continue, given our track record over the past 20 years and in other contexts as well. So the question then is if and when to go after this nuclear program militarily. I would make 3 points. Number one, diplomacy was not exhausted a week ago today when Israel went in. To their credit, the Trump administration has, I think, demonstrated a willingness to sit down with adversaries and to engage in diplomacy with adversaries. We tend not to look, we don't. Diplomacy was made for our adversaries in many ways. It's not something that we need to engage in as concertedly with our allies because we often see eye to eye. So I applauded the fact that they were doing that. And those talks were ongoing. And in fact, Steve Witkoff was supposed to meet with his Iranian with the Iranian foreign minister just a couple days after the Israelis began this operation. A related point, diplomacy is still an option. It has not run its course. I think it's much harder now, and the Iranians are maintaining a public hard line that they won't engage in talks while the Israelis are bombing. But it's not impossible that we could see discussions ongoing. And in fact, there are some reports that Steve Witkoff has continued those discussions.
So let me just insert this. If I understand what you're saying, is that the enemy is Iranian nuclear weapons or weaponization. The enemy is not the Iranians, no matter how distasteful they are to us and annoying and a threat to us in, you know, by using its proxies, the Houthis and so on. But our enemy is the nuclear weaponization, not the Iranian regime.
Look, that is absolutely my view, that we should aim our efforts at ensuring the objective that every president, including Donald Trump, has said, Iran must not obtain a nuclear weapon. And our efforts in terms of the diplomacy, and in terms of the credible military threat that, you know, presidents since George W. Bush have developed, that would be aimed at Iran's nuclear program. We have never talked about this in the context of regime change. Now, what Israel wants and whether their end game may be different from ours, I couldn't say. I think there are credible indications they may want a regime change program rather than just an operation aimed squarely at Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile and military infrastructure. But I couldn't tell you that for sure. Two other very quick points. Diplomacy was not exhausted. Number two, only diplomacy can permanently and verifiably ensure that Iran never obtains a nuclear weapon. And my concern is that if we do go after this militarily, Iran in the aftermath, whether that's in the coming months or coming years or coming decades, will have every incentive to turbocharge their efforts to reconstitute a covert clandestine nuclear program that will be even more heavily fortified than the kinds of things we're seeing buried deep in Fordo today. And then, look, number three.
Some would argue the horse has already left the barn on that one. Given the Israeli attack, they've got every incentive in the world to accelerate its nuclear program at this point, to the extent but they can, right?
Well, but that's exactly my point, Michael. So if we only go after this militarily, we're just going to incentivize them to do this more covertly and more stealthily. If we actually take a diplomatic approach and we once again have some sort of deal, imagine this, if there were ever some sort of deal that could permanently and verifiably put Iran's nuclear program in a box and ensure that they didn't, that they weren't able to acquire a nuclear weapon, that would be a good thing. Very quickly, just number three, diplomacy is not exhausted. Only diplomacy can ensure that this is permanent and verifiable. And if we go the military route, number three, it puts a target on the backs of 40,000 American service members who are in the region, the thousands of American diplomats who are in our embassies and diplomatic posts in the region, and the hundreds of thousands of Americans, private American citizens who are in the region in what would be a needless war. Because again, the military option does not get us ultimately what we want. And that's a permanent way out of this nuclear challenge.
So you have criticized Trump during his first term for, you know, abandoning the nuclear agreement that was signed under Obama with Iran. But a major criticism of that agreement was, while it did address the nuclear program, it did not address Iran's other malign activity in the region, which, you know, when you look at it in, you know, especially over the last few years, you know, the arming and funding of Hamas for its attack on Israel on October 7th, the arming and funding of the Houthis with their, you know, missile attacks on ship lanes. I mean, there's a lot, not to mention Hezbollah, which, you know, the Israelis have crippled at this point. But, you know, there was a lot of really nasty stuff that the Iranians were doing, including shooting missiles at our bases and our troops in in Iraq, killing, and they killed three soldiers last year in Jordan with a attack. So, you know, this gets to, you know, even if you had the agreement with the nuclear program, it would not stop a lot of what Iran is doing that, you know, is counter to our interests.
Yeah, look, two points on that. Number one, if in 2014, 2015, or before or ever since, the United States were able to seal a deal that would have said, number one, Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. Number two, Iran can't have a ballistic missile program. Number three, Iran has to treat its citizens the right way. Number four, Iran has to stop funding proxies throughout the region. And number five, Iran has to turn itself into a Jeffersonian democracy. Of course, you know, we would have jumped at that. Diplomacy is the art of the possible. It's not precisely everything you want. Point number two, the nuclear deal was aimed at the nuclear program. And Iran with a nuclear weapon, or on the very cusp of a nuclear weapon, already with some of that deterrent capability, every single challenge you mentioned would be hypercharged. They would have a sense of invincibility far beyond what they felt, let's say, prior to October 7th, because Iran has been taken down a notch or two since then. And if Iran had a nuclear weapon or were on the cusp of one, you can bet they would be doing so much more throughout the region and would be in some ways untouchable, whether by us, whether by the Israelis, by anyone who sought to go after this. So we always made very clear that even though this deal was about the nuclear program only, it didn't stop us from using aggressively every single tool that we had to go after this regime, whether it's sanctions, whether it's interdictions, whether it is various things in the intelligence world. We have used that toolkit to go after them, even if we haven't been able to degrade their capabilities as much as we like, or even if we had not. Because, again, since October 7th, Iran is far weakened. Its proxies have been diminished. Hezbollah has been decapitated. Hamas is essentially decimated. The Shia militias have been neutered in many ways. The Quds force has been diminished as well. So Iran today is not the Iran of 2023.
I have to go back to, right, you are. They've been really taken down a notch, as you say, and more. Quds Force commanders have been assassinated. This should be, we used to say the worst job in the world was to be Al-Qaeda's number two, you know?
Yeah.
You don't want to be number two in the Quds Force because you got a target on your back.
I think it was the Al-Qaeda number three position that was probably even more, even riskier.
I want to go back to the national security decision-making in the Trump administration. Administration right now. We hang on a hinge, historic hinge of whether we're going to be deeply involved in a war, et cetera, et cetera. And the reports I'm reading of decision making is that, you know, that Pete Hegseth and John Radcliffe and Tulsi Gabbard, the top titular heads of national security organs, are not really in the picture. That General Kurilla, calls a gorilla, you know, is formulating policy in the Middle East, et cetera. I mean, whether one agrees with the Obama policies or not, we knew who was in charge, and we knew that the people holding those positions had vast credentials and experience upon which to make rational decisions about our foreign policy, military policy. But right now, doesn't this give you pause that we don't really, we can't be comfortable in who's calling the shots here?
I think in some ways we can almost set aside the vanquished, you know, the vaunted institutional experience and reputations that people bring to the table. What worries me more about the current moment is that there doesn't seem to be the sort of inclusive, deliberative process that brings the various voices representing the departments and agencies across the national security and foreign policy realm into the Situation Room to give the president their best advice. You're referring to the fact, Jeff, that Pete Hegseth is apparently on the outs. Not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. You're referring to the fact that Tulsi Gabbard is reportedly on the outs. Maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But it is pretty remarkable, if you looked at the reporting over the past couple of days, which I know you have, that apparently the only way the president's director of national intelligence thinks that she can influence his decision-making process and steer the broader dialogue is by releasing a cryptic video regarding the risk that the global elites pose to nuclear annihilation. And
was she talking about with these global warmongers, elite warmongers? I guess she was directing at the Democrats, and suddenly it's boomeranging onto the man she works for.
I don't know about you, but when I first saw that video, I thought, oh, this is more the same Tulsi Gabbard who was warning about our support for Ukraine and that our support for Ukraine and the security assistance that we're providing is going to goad the Russians into some sort of nuclear deployment, which would then lead to nuclear annihilation. It seems quite clear now, given some of the reporting, that she was actually aiming that video at the ongoing dialogue or lack thereof, it may well be, regarding decision making vis-a-vis Iran's nuclear program. But the fact that these individuals, whether you agree with them or not, look, they are there not to offer their personal opinions. And again, this is how it should be, how it ought to be, not necessarily how it is in this administration, but they're there to give the best judgments, advice, and assessments that their departments and agencies are putting forward. And so the fact that Tulsi Gabbard isn't in the room, that Pete Hegseth may be diminished, that a very small number of advisors are reportedly calling the shots, President Trump and his small team, they are missing the institutional perspectives that our foreign policy establishment bring to bear. And they're hearing, it seems, from voices who may come at this with a predisposed opinion about what we should do or should not do when it comes to Iran.
So, Ned, having been in the thick of decision-making on these sorts of national security issues for many years, what's your gut about what Trump's going to do here?
Look, it's hard to say. And every time I'm confident one way or another, he'll say something that lessens my confidence. I think if I had to say today, I think we've seen plenty of data points to indicate that he has made a decision to go forward. According to the Wall Street Journal, at least, he hasn't given that final order yet. He's sort of waiting to see how things play out. But, you know, that somewhat strange post on Twitter by JD Vance, making the case that the president deserves trust on this issue. The same president who got us here, I think, by tearing up the nuclear deal in 2018, and we should give him the decision-making space to make the decision that he feels is right for the United States. The fact that, you know, President Trump has stated very clearly that Iran has made a huge mistake, the fact that he has made other foreboding statements along those lines, I think all of those data points, at least for right now, and we should say we're talking on, you know, Thursday, June 19th, point in the direction of the United States using this capability against Fordo. Now, I think ultimately President Trump wants to be for whatever goes well or whatever will be popular. And so if he...
He's got his fingers in the wind.
Exactly. And so it could all change. And I think there's one big wild card. If there is any sort of last ditch Hail Mary diplomatic process, and the Euros, the so-called E3, are engaged in this right now, whether the Iranians actually come back to the table in a way that is enticing to the Trump administration. Look, I actually do think President Trump would like a way out of this that he could label as a gigantic success without having to get militarily involved. I'm skeptical the Iranians will give him that, however, unfortunately.
Well, I'll go out on a limb and say he flinches in the end and does not do it. Let the Israelis go at it, do as much as they can, and then urge them to, you know, call it quits and declare victory and get out. I've got, but anyway, one of us will be right.
That's right.
In the next week or so,
by the time we gather next week for the Spy Talk podcast, we may be looking at an entirely different world. Hopefully, a safer one.
I got one last question for Nick.
Yeah.
All right, I looked up your 2017 op-ed in the Washington Post when you quit the CIA in protest over you weren't going to work for President Donald Trump in his first term. Just wanted to prepare for our podcast. And you wrote then, to be clear, my decision had nothing to do with politics, and I would have been proud to again work under a Republican administration open to intelligence and analysis. I served with conviction under President Bush, some of whose policies I also found troubling, and I took part in programs that the Obama administration criticized and ended. What were those programs?
This is all public now, but I started at CIA in 2006, and this was still in the somewhat immediate aftermath of 9/11. That was certainly the mentality of the intelligence community at the time, and I was a terrorism analyst, and I was working for the Counterterrorism Center, which reported through the Directorate of Operations, which then became the National Clandestine Service and is now back in the other direction. So there still was the so-called RDI program, Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation program.
The secret sites and enhanced interrogation. Nasty stuff.
And there were things going on then that... I think as a 22-year-old, I looking back now as a 42-year-old, I wish I had more perspective to, think in terms of what not only what could we do, but what should we be doing? And, with experience in government, with that perspective, I hope I would have had a different approach to those issues back then. But those were issues that I was exposed to and some of the issues that my work ultimately did touch.
And Ned, I hope you get a second chance.
I do too.
Time will tell. Anyway, Ned, thanks. It was a great discussion. And
we'll see. Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us, Ned. It's been great. Thank you. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the SpyTalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. See you next week. I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Michael Iskoff.
See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.